Welcome to Insights and Indicators. I'm Jason Thomas, Carlyle's Head of Global Research and Investment Strategy. In this podcast, I share observations and opinions on the economic landscape, as well as insights from research being conducted by our team here at Carlyle. Today, I'm joined by Mark Jenkins, Carlyle's Head of Global Credit, for a discussion about credit markets and the landscape ahead. This episode was recorded on May 28th, 2024, and the discussion reflects composite portfolio data and analysis of recent government reports that are accurate as of that date. Before turning over to Mark, I just want to talk a bit about what we've seen in our portfolio and just the broader markets generally. And I think it's important to start by prefacing the discussion with the recognition that we are living deep in the tail of the distribution. And what I mean by that is if we were to go back to June 2021, at that time, inflation had risen well above Fed's target. It was about 5.5% at that time. And if you looked at futures markets, if you looked at forward interest rates extracted from the yield curve, base rates today were expected to be less than 1%. I think what's more interesting is that if you use the implied volatility from swaptions or from options on futures, you realize that interest rates, base interest rates in excess of 5% would be something like a 4 or 5 sigma event. So, you know, about a 1 in 1 million likelihood. And yet here we are today, base interest rates still about 5.3%. And what's so remarkable is that the economy seems quite able to withstand them. It's one thing when you have base interest rates at 5%, when inflation's running at 5%, that's, you know, real interest rates in that scenario are about zero. Nobody's surprised the economy can withstand that. But since the start of the year, as inflation has come down, moved towards Fed's target, you have this continued increase in real rates today, you know, in excess of 2% for 1 year and really throughout the yield curve. And yet what we've seen in the portfolio data is hardly an economy collapsing. Continue to see not only consumer spending grow, but also an enormous amount of profitable investment opportunities, particularly related to, of course, data centers and other hardware related to the AI revolution. Of course, lots of investment in green industry, renewable energy, related to both tax incentives and also the commercial opportunities. We see, of course, the stock market reaching all-time highs, not showing any signs that earnings growth in the corporate sector is buckling from these, what we would have thought to be excessively high real interest rates. So as a result, I think we're in a situation where maybe the Fed will get to a rate cut or two this year. I think that that's still quite reasonable to anticipate. But I think the cumulative effect of these data is that, you know, looking out over the next 3 to 5 years, people have to be much more willing to contemplate base interest rates, you know, 90-day SOFR, that average somewhere in the range of 4 to 4.5%. And I would say that's probably maybe 200 basis points above where most people were considering these rates would be, again, over a longer-term horizon, as recently as 6 months ago. So again, it's not just that the economic data look fairly decent. It's more of what hasn't happened, which is, again, an economy that many people, I think, would have expected to collapse under the weight of real interest rates that are now 300 basis points above those that prevailed over the past decade. So with that, I'm very glad to be joined by Mark today. We actually published a paper together recently that hopefully was well received. I certainly enjoyed working on it very much with Mark. And I just want to start with a question about the state of credit markets. We focus on, and of course, it's a key indicator for the Fed, we're thinking about financial conditions, high yield bond spreads. And if you just look at single B spreads today, they are right around, or if not inside of 300 basis points, which is extremely tight, probably about the fifth percentile of the historic distribution, and really not far from the all-time tights we saw in the spring of 2007. So how are you feeling about the credit markets and the capital deployment opportunities in this space?
Yeah, thanks, Jason. I would say a couple things. One is, yes, we are experiencing, you know, near all-time tights, especially in a high yield. I think going back to 2007, difference obviously is we're in a slightly higher rate environment. So when you look on a yield basis, it's still attractive relative, we think, to other alternatives out there. I think what's driving a little bit of what you see in 2024 is what was set up in 2023, which is we really had a limited amount of M&A activity, very limited issuance, if you will. And what you saw through the course of 2023 with corporates, and I'm talking specifically if you looked in, you know, our portfolios, both on the CLO side, but also on the private side, is a unbelievable pivot for corporate management to conservation of cash and cash management. And in fact, as you came into 2024, what we actually saw are companies had stewarded enough cash that they were not only servicing debt, but also paying down debt through that period of time. So coming into 2024, you had corporate balance sheets and some sponsor balance sheets that were in very good shape from a leverage perspective. And what you also saw is a technical buildup of dry powder, both on the private side and on the and the capital market side put to work. So I think a confluence of those two events coming together. So there's been a lack of supply even today, I would say, for large opportunities. That's why you're seeing pricing come in. Spreads in private credit have repriced generally in the area of a larger deals about 100 to 125 basis points over the past 5 months. And you've seen pricing come in comparably on the bank syndicated loan side as well. And that's really happened as a result of not a lot of new issuance, but actually a repricing of existing deals.
So relative to high yield bonds, where are spreads today in the syndicated loan market? Where are they in private credit, would you say?
Yeah, the tights on the syndicated loan market are inside of 400, 375 for good quality names. Now you have to remember bank syndicated loans, generally over 67%, almost 70% go to CLOs. CLOs are very limited as to what types of credit risks they're willing to take, i.e. they're not willing to take low single B or triple C risk. And so you tend to have higher quality names go into CLOs as a result. Private credit, you can look at the numbers, leverage tends to be on average about one turn higher. And so as a result, you're seeing spreads there come into around 500 and they had been as wide as 650, sort of at the best of the worst of the market in 2023.
You know, we've talked a lot in recent months just about the amount of capital that's being deployed in a real sense, talking about fixed capital, again, in the construction of industrial facilities, data centers, you know, obviously 30 battery plants that are in various stages of the construction process, semiconductors. To what extent is all this spurring demand for credit? Are you seeing those changes in your market?
Yeah, I would say in particular, and I think what's surprised us a little bit is the amount of capital that's going into what I would call infrastructure for AI. So when you look at a data center, for instance, not only the chips that have to be pre-ordered and purchased, if you will, but it's also the construction of that facility, the power that's required for that facility, and the immense amount of capital that goes into that. We recently were involved in a large transaction, CoreWeave, which was a second financing of a total of roughly $9 billion going into roughly half a gig of data centers collectively. I think there were 16 of them individually. The data center build expectation going forward is multiple gigs going forward, requiring billions upon billions of dollars to go into that space. And I think that really wasn't accounted for if you looked back 2 or 3 years. The energy transition that we're experiencing, I think, you know, these are numbers I think I got from you, Jason, are roughly we're going to broach around $3 trillion a year by 2030, maybe even before that. And you're seeing, you know, large amounts of capital going into that. We see that on the infrastructure side. And I would say the last big element we're seeing is, you know, demand for what I would call more investment grade private credit. And that is going into all of these large developments. Like there is investment grade going into data centers. There is investment grade going into energy transition projects as well. And, you know, we're experiencing a wave of asset-backed finance in private credit that we weren't experiencing 3 years ago as well.
I want to turn to credit performance. What are you seeing in the portfolio? There was a lot of concern, of course, I guess the middle of last year, even the end of last year, about defaults picking up. How are things looking on the performance side?
Yeah. So performance-wise, I would say I can only speak to our portfolios. They're doing probably better than expected. And I think when you look at the broader index, if you will, and JP Morgan being a good indicator of that, I think on average, defaults are hovering around 3%. Long-term historic default rates have been about 3%. So from a historic perspective, I think things are going pretty well. The actual numbers recorded are slightly less than 3%, because a unique thing is happening in the bank syndicated loan market is, instead of going through actual bankruptcies or restructurings, we're going through distressed debt exchanges. So effectively what is happening is, when loans start trading in and around 80 cents or lower to the dollar, you do see borrowers coming to you to affect what I would call distressed exchange. And so that actually, when you factor that in, you're around 3.25% from that type of what I would call default, even though those aren't actual defaults. So I think we're not in a bad space. When we look, dig into our portfolio numbers, I think the thing that is surprising on the upside is the year-over-year EBITDA. When we took a look at both Q3 and Q4, Q1 of 2024, those numbers are just coming in. Those numbers were relatively robust, even as top-line sales were going down, which says to us that companies are learning how to be more productive, whether that's cutting out costs or figuring out how to do things more productively. The offset to that, and you and I talked about this, is between debt servicing and getting costs out of your structure, the concern is, are you taking excess capital to reinvest into the business for growth? And I think that's the biggest concern that I have when I look overall at the portfolios, is, are people reinvesting for that growth down the road that'll allow them to refinance out of the debt, sell the company, et cetera. And that to me is sort of the bigger overall picture right now, is things look pretty good from a credit perspective, but that growth perspective is the thing that I'm concerned about.
I guess that's a concern more for the equity holder, you would think. I mean, they're the ones that are pricing for the upside, you know, concerned about that maybe not materializing. I guess another issue related to that, you know, when rates moved up, of course, there were a lot of deals in 2020, 2021, prices were high, putting 7 or 8 times debt on the company. Really wasn't all that much from an LTV perspective, sometimes 30%, 40%. So lots of subordination, big equity buffers, but interest coverage ratios, of course, fell pretty significantly as a result of that. Is this the same situation you're alluding to with not much cash to reinvest, or has there been any distress in that space?
Yeah. So what you're referring to is, there was a period of time between late 20 and 21, if you will, in the early 22, where there was like actually just a raft of deals done on the sponsor side. And those deals, as you know, were done in the highest multiple environment with the lowest interest rate environment. So those capital structures, and by the way, like we look back now and think, of course, rates were going to go up, but nobody thought that at the time.
Exactly.
So they were all set in this, rates are going to stay lower for forever. And those capital structures, by and large, just don't work in today's environment. So when you go to refinance those capital structures, the interest burden on it is such that you've got good enterprise value, to your point, but you know, effectively, you've got a little bit too much leverage in this higher rate environment to manage. And so what that creates is an opportunity for us on the junior capital side to provide capital to reinvest, to your point, for growth, that allows them to kind of earn their way out of that position. And you do that by putting in junior capital structures that have subordination, interest deferral, that allows them to steward that cash to reinvest in growth.
Final question I wanted to cover, that is something that we covered in our paper, and it's really just about the bank disintermediation. You know, something that has been going on now for a long, long time. The share of household savings and bank deposits, if you look at bank balance sheets, contribution to overall credit markets, it's been declining since the 1970s, but certainly has taken on new interest recently because of the growth of private credit. And I'm just wondering if you could sort of summarize where you see this process today.
Yeah, I would say we're in the early stages of the second phase. And what I mean by that is, if you looked at the late 90s or early 2000s, that first wave of, I don't want to call it disintermediation, but really where banks were kind of moving from the inventory to shipping position was in leveraged credit. And we saw that, like today, banks hold less than 3% of leveraged loans from the bank syndicated loan market. The next wave, and that's been going on, you know, since pre-GFC, and we're at the back end of that, and that's been the growth of private credit as we know it on the leverage side. The next wave is what you hear a lot about, is asset-backed finance, which is predominantly investment-grade private credit. Think of it as homogeneous pooled loans that the banks originate, whether that be for manufactured housing, could be for solar power, you know, renovations, could be other types of consumer debt, could be student loans. The banks are now, given the onset of more regulation, looking to manage down their risk-weighted assets. And some of these products, which they still want to maintain from an origination standpoint for the reasons you and I discussed in that paper, is to maintain that client contact, want to also be able to originate more loans. And as a result of that, have to manage down their positions. And so people like us and others are packaging those and putting them into our funds with our investors and providing, you know, real incremental yield for our investors over just regular way investment grade. And that market relative to private credit, which is about $1.7 trillion, is roughly a $46 trillion market. So I think we're in the early stages of that, and we're seeing that today. And that is a secular change that, frankly, I think investors will benefit from over the years, not months from now.
Just a final question. The banks have come back into the leverage lending market in a big way this year, facilitating repricings. Of course, much of this is just because of the CLO formation. The easier it is to distribute the loans, the more interested banks are to originate them. But what effect has this had on pricing? Are there any parts of the market where the impact has been, you know, material from your perspective?
Well, I think, as I mentioned, the peak pricing in private credit was in, you know, absent a major dislocation, was in 2023. And yeah. So we've seen prices stabilize or come in, I'd say 100 to 150 basis points on the private side. But you got to remember, if you want to think about it this way, is in direct lending, right, which is top of the capital structure, at 5 or 5.50 over, unleveraged at 10 to 11%.
Yeah.
Which outstrips sort of long-term forecasts for public equity returns. If you look at the junior part of the capital structure, you're talking something that's more in the mid-teens. So you're still getting, we think, good risk-adjusted returns in an environment where we've gone through 4 years of major volatility, where we feel like we've got, you know, not that the world has stopped being volatile, but we think it's less volatile.
Yeah, that is a remarkable total return in the context of public stock markets at all-time highs. You know, again, as you said, long-term return expectations probably between 7 and 9%. I'm not sure what people's return expectations are from these levels, but I suspect it's not 10, 11, you know, 12% returns that you're citing in the top of the capital structure. Well, Mark, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate you joining me and sharing your insights.
Thank you, Jason. It's good to talk.
On behalf of the team here at Carlyle, thank you for listening. And I hope you join us again for our next episode of Insights and Indicators.